You're listening to extracts from the Saturday Weekend Edition, first broadcast on the 28th of June 2014. Hello, I'm Georgina Godwin. During the Weekend Edition on Saturday, the 28th of June 2014, we had a very literary day. I spoke to writer Nick Harkaway, also debut novelist Caris Bray, and joined the architect of Europe's biggest new bookshop. I started by playing my first guest a piece of music. And that is Jenny Lewis with Acid Tongue. It was the choice of the writer Nick Harkaway. I'm absolutely thrilled that he's joining me here today. He's been in before talking about his non-fiction book about technology, The Blind Giant. But he's also written three novels, The Garnaway World, Angel Maker, and now just published Tiger Man. The London Sunday Times called it bonkers, brilliant and hilarious, effervescent, clever and entirely fantastic. Whilst William Gibson of the New York Times says it's extremely entertaining and exciting. And it is all of these things. Welcome, Nick.
Hello.
Listen, that piece of music, great piece of music. And we were just chatting while it was on about how you have a playlist to write to.
I have to, I because otherwise I get distracted by random street noise. As long as something's sort of relatively regular, then I don't mind. I don't really notice that it's there. So what I do is I tend to line up sort of 20 songs and they go on an endless loop. And that was one of the ones that I've been using recently. I can't remember whether I was editing Tiger Man with it or whether I was writing the new book. But in any case, that's been in my head for a while now.
Does it become sort of like a background for you, or do you stop noticing? Is the whole thing of it that you don't notice it anymore because it's the same song?
It's regular and predictable, so I don't notice. And it means that if someone starts mowing the lawn or if a car alarm goes off or whatever, then I don't notice that and I just keep on working. Although I do tend to get into a quite focused bubble when I'm writing anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about this latest book, Tiger Man. Ex-colony, superheroes, paternal love. Those are all themes that surface in the book. And actually, when you describe it like that, it seems like they're all quite different, but you weave them together.
Lots of disparate things go into my books. And I do try to make them all feel kind of coherent and part of one thing. It's a little bit like being a stand-up comedian, but you get 18 months to be funny for the first time, in that you start with a single, relatively simple thread. And as long as the thread kind of continues through the story and so on, that's fine. And then you can hang all kinds of other stuff on it. And at the end of the process, it looks like a tapestry. But you didn't immediately think of it as a kind of perfect tapestry with all this imagery all over it. You just think of it as a single thread.
Mm. Although this book seems to have a definite kind of break in it. There seems to be a sort of before and after, isn't there, really?
Yes, I suppose so. I mean, you know, they cross a Rubicon. But, I mean, that is, you know, in a sense, that's always how story structures work. I mean, it's classic myth structure without getting too kind of sort of highfalutin, which actually George Lucas used for Star Wars, is that you have a sort of a hero who has to be summoned repeatedly to action, and then things go increasingly wrong and they have to meet further and greater challenges until they can resolve the situation and return in some sense to the status quo or a new status quo. It's a very, I mean, storytelling is old and, you know, the structures are relatively well known, the shapes of stories. So you almost always have to have some kind of point of no return quite early on in the story, after which you are committed.
Mm. Now you were talking about the superheroes, and of course at the heart of it there is this kind of sort of Batman and Robin type relationship. It's a very beautiful friendship between a grown man and a young boy, and it's a relationship that many people stay away from exploring. Was it difficult to write, given the connotations of you know, the difficulty between older man, younger boy?
I just wrote it as a parental relationship. And obviously you're conscious of that creepiness as a possibility. But as long as, because the central character, Lester, is the father figure, and we're basically, although we're not inside his head because it's told us we're focused on him all the time, you know, so there's no ambiguity about their relationship because it's just right there in front of you. You see everything. And so you know that what he wants desperately out of this is fatherhood. And so, you know, it just, in a sense, it doesn't enter into the equation.
Mm-hmm. Did you find, because I know that you fairly recently, when you were writing other books, became a father, and then just before this book, became a father for the second time. Is it a book that you could only have written as a father?
Well, I actually wrote the first draft of this book while my wife was pregnant with our first child. And then I put it away and then finished it later because I had other books to do in the meantime. And so it was always about fatherhood in my life. It was, you know, my kind of burning concern. And I think, yes, I mean, I think I would have written it differently if I didn't have children. But that, I mean, the original concept of a man who is alone and desperate not to be was something that I wrote, you know, very, very early on in that process. So I, you know, I remembered the kind of the sense of wanting to be a dad.
Let's have some dad music. It's Daddy Cool, of course, from Boney M. That's Boney M and Daddy Cool. I'm talking to Nick Harkaway, who's the author of Tiger Man, amongst other books. Nick, we were just saying that there really isn't enough Boney M in the world.
No, indeed, until there is a radio station playing it 24/7.
Nick, your wonderful, wonderful book, which has had absolutely glowing reviews. Now, one of the problems for a reviewer is just how much they can give away. And of course, we don't want to give away too much of the plot here, not least because I haven't quite finished the book, so I don't want to know what happens at the end. But give us an idea.
Well, okay, so I suppose what you have is a man who is exhausted, and he's been a soldier in some bad places. And finally, he's turning 40 and he's being retired from active service. And so he is sent to serve out his time on an island, a temporary posting. And his job is essentially to drink tea, talk to everybody, and not under any circumstances notice any of the bad things that are happening there. But because he is alone and doesn't want to be, he makes friends with this boy. And the boy, meanwhile, needs him to see all the terrible stuff that's happening on this island, needs him to see all of it and do something about it. So there's an immediate conflict. And they, I suppose, they sort of dicker about this. And then an event takes place where someone they know is murdered. And at the same time, the boy's dignity is infringed and he's subjected to an ordeal which offends the sergeant's sense of how the world ought to be very much. And in the combination of those two things, he is persuaded to put on a costume and quote unquote fight crime. Mm. And I mean, it is in a sense a superhero story because obviously it harks to Batman, but like Batman, he doesn't have any magical powers. He's just a guy in a hat and or a costume. And it's worth bearing in mind that unlike Batman, he's not a multimillionaire. There's a very clever kind of discussion about whether Batman's superpower is just he's massively wealthy. And Lester Ferris very much is not. He's yeah. just a guy.
Yeah. Now, the way that certainly the voice of the young boy who's obsessed with comics and whose English comes through completely sort of received it through various
movies and the yeah. internet. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That was great fun to write. I mean, it's a world that I love, and I love the way that new developments and different places and different people reconstruct English. And I think, you know, the sort of broader English, the wider English, is what makes English so vibrant. You know, there are ridiculous numbers of words in the English language in kind of, I think it's somewhere between 500,000 and 1,000,000 if you include all the variations and jargons and so on that exist, which is a vast number for a language. You only need, you know, a few thousand words to express things. So, you know, it's a vast language. And part of that is this kind of crazy richness of new internet expressions and so on. Mm. I has the feels and all that stuff. And it's just, I love it. I just think it's great.
Mm-hmm. And it works incredibly well in this book. You've really, I don't know, the two main characters are so very alive for me. And I wonder how that works for you as the author.
I mean, with all my characters, they're all me on some level or other, you know, and I inhabit either side of the conversation, and it's not unknown for me to sort of lean one way in my chair and talk as one, and then lean the other, and so on, while I'm reading it or editing it or writing it in the first place. I mean, it's very, you know, it's a very kind of active process, that's where it comes from. It's a dialogue, you know, that I absolutely have, and I read my work aloud to myself or to my wife or whatever to make sure that it makes sense.
And then, of course, it's finished. What happens after you've put down your pen?
It feels, it's funny, we were talking about this yesterday, you've got an imprint in your head that's like the imprint left in the mud by a boot or something, and it's still there. The boot's moved on. You know, it's gone somewhere else. Someone's walked away, and you've still got this place in your head with this space where there ought to be this narrative, and it's finished. It's very, very odd, and it takes a little while for it to kind of even out and go away, and then you can start writing something else. It's a very odd experience finishing a book, and equally odd is publication day, when you feel that there ought to be something cataclysmic happening, but actually there's nothing for you to do because your job is done. You know, usually you talk to people and maybe you do some press and so on, but broadly speaking, actually on publication day, the best thing you can be doing is writing the next book.
Are you writing the next book?
I am always writing the next book. And at the moment I'm writing the next book, and it's driving me crazy because I'm actually sort of midway through it. And inevitably, there's always a kind of wrestling match in the middle of a book where you know much more about it than when you started. Some of the assumptions that you made about how you were going to write it and what was really going on at the beginning turn out to be wrong. You've got to go back, retread the whole thing, rework it, and find the story which you meant to tell, or alternatively, the story it now turns out you ought to be telling. Mm. Probably both.
Nick, I want to pick up on this idea of publication day. It's all over, but all you can do now is publicise it, because, of course, you have to do the rounds. You have to come and talk to people like me about it. But there are lots of really fun things to do. They're all the literary festivals, for a start.
Yeah, absolutely. They're extraordinary. And they're extraordinary on two levels. I mean, the first thing is you get to go out on the stage and talk about all the things that have been stewing away in your head for a couple of years, and kind of answer questions which you hope will prompt you to say something terrifically interesting. And then on the other level, you're sitting, I mean, writers generally speaking don't really kind of necessarily get to meet one another very often. You know, it's by definition a relatively solitary activity, although not quite as solitary as it's sometimes portrayed. And so the green room at a literary festival is very exciting because you can kind of say, oh my goodness, you know, that's so-and-so, and I really want to talk to her about that book she wrote, which is amazing. And it's great fun. And there's a democracy of the green room. You can talk to almost anybody. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they don't get to say, who on earth are you, go away. Instead of which they say, gosh, how terribly interesting.
But of course, you also get to do other fun things like the literary death match. It sounds amazing. Aww. What is it? Is it happening next week? I know.
You've got to love it. I absolutely adore LDM. It's one of the first things I did with my first book. And it actually taught me a lot about performing in public. It was the place where I really got a handle on what it is to read to a group of people who've kind of paid for entry and, you know, whatever. And you really don't have to do. There's always a sort of slightly schoolmarmish feeling about reading in public, that you're standing at the front with a tome and they've all got to pay attention and sit up straight, and it's a terrible feeling, and it absolutely doesn't work. Whereas with literary deathmatch, when the concept is you have four writers, each of whom gets 7 minutes to read and to entertain you, and you're matched up against one another in the first round, one versus one and the other one versus the other one, and you get a slightly spurious and goofy response from three judges on sort of presentation, literary value, and I can't remember the third one. And it's very much not the X Factor. It's very kind and gentle and fun. It's slightly more Never Mind the Buzzcocks, really. And whoever wins that round, which is in any case sort of, as it were, wonderfully meaningless, then has to go and do something like duel with water pistols in order to win a prize the nature of which totally escapes me. It's great fun. It's a really enjoyable evening. And I've done it once as a writer, and I've done it once as a judge. And both of those things are hugely enjoyable.
Well, in fact, you're doing it this Thursday, and you're doing it as part of the Foyles opening festival.
Yes.
Have you been to the new Foyles?
I haven't been, no, because I've been so busy. The book came out at the end of May, and it's been a kind of flat sprint for me doing sort of bookshop events and so on. I've discovered some wonderful bookshops, mostly books in Abingdon and Mr. B's Emporium in Bath and so on. Just really tremendous kind of independent bookstores. And I'm just, you know, it's been absolutely incredible, but it has been a rush.
Mm-hmm. Well, you'll see it on Thursday when you're there to do the literary death match. Nick, finally, before you go, I know we've got one more piece of music that we're going to play, and I want you to tell me about your choice of Washington Square.
I just love this song. I don't know where it comes from. It popped up, I think, as it were, in my Twitter feed. It just came into my awareness kind of semi-randomly, and I just really rather like it, and it's gone into the rotation for various books and so on. One of the things that I do with my playlist is I pick out things. I have different playlists, and some of them are upbeat and some of them are not, some of them are very quiet. This is for writing kind of bouncy kind of jaunty stuff. And it's very, it lifts my mood. I just enjoy it.
And Nick Harkaway, you lift my mood, as does your book, and as will the Literary Death Match, which is happening on Thursday. And just a note about that, that somebody else who's participating in it is Caris Bray.
Yes.
She'll be in here actually a little bit later on today. She's talking about her debut novel. It's called A Song for Issy Bradley. So four authors, three judges, two rounds, one epic final. The Literary Death Match, that's happening on Thursday. A Song for Issy Bradley is the first novel by the prize-winning writer Caris Bray. Set in a small town on the Ribble estuary, it tells the story of a family of Lancashire Mormons whose measured existence is shattered by the death of their youngest daughter, Issy. Well, I'm absolutely delighted to be joined in the studio by Caris Bray, and I'm also completely surprised that you can fit us in, because having a look at your schedule, it's just gone completely mad. This book has exploded onto the literary scene.
Oh gosh, that feels really a strange thing to hear in reference to to me. But yeah, I have been really busy, and it's been very exciting and slightly overwhelming actually. But yeah, it's been lovely.
Now, this is your debut novel, but it's not like you're an unpublished writer. You've written one prize-winning short story book. Mm-hmm. Now, tell me about that, because winning a prize obviously does change things in your literary career, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. So I won Salt Publishing's Scott Prize, which is a prize for an unpublished short story collection. And yeah, it was a really, really exciting thing to happen. And that's how my short story collection got published. And yeah, it suddenly seemed a bit more achievable, really, to, you know, to maybe go on and have something else published. And I thought, you know, it might be nice to have a go at a novel. So I did.
And this has been the result. It is getting absolutely incredible reviews all over the place. Now, you're doing a creative writing PhD. You haven't mm-hmm. even finished it, actually.
Not quite, no.
So, I mean, this novel is coming out. This is, in fact, your work for your PhD, isn't it?
It is, and it will be accompanied by a piece of poetics, which is essentially just writing about process and thinking about the putting together of the novel, which I have finished, and I'm just waiting for my final viva, which will happen over the summer. So,
I think you can probably predict the results, don't you?
Hopefully.
Caris, I want to go right back to the beginning, because this is a book that is very much about your own upbringing. And although it's not autobiographical, mm-hmm. of course, it's based on some of your experiences.
Yeah.
Because you were born into the Mormon faith.
I was, yeah. So my parents both converted when they were younger. I think my dad was 19, I think, and my mum was in her 20s. And so they brought us up, you know, so we were born into the faith, and I'm the oldest of five children. So I grew up, you know, not knowing any different, and actually having quite a happy childhood as a Mormon. There were always things happening at church. There's lots of activities, lots of fun, sort of a big community of people. Well, I say big, you know, I think there are about 100 and 120 practicing Mormons in Southport. So you know, community of people who knew me from when I was a baby, and it was there were a lot of things that were very nice about it.
Being within that community, did you have a sense of the fact that it was actually quite unusual, and that although there may have been 120 of you, there are millions that aren't, and perhaps view it as a slightly odd thing to be?
Not for a while, no. I mean, I knew at school that other people didn't go to church, but it sort of felt like, it sort of felt lucky, really. You know, it felt special to sort of have this sort of different way of doing things. I think it's only really when I sort of hit my teens, you know, and your friends start having a sneaky cigarette after school and things, and obviously if you're a Mormon you don't join in with that, that's when the differences start to become more obvious, I think.
Mm. You've left the faith now, but tell mm-hmm. me about that journey, going from being really a reverent, I suppose, mm-hmm. a Mormon to now not being part of the religion at all.
So I got I married fellow Mormon, and we had five children in the first 7 years of our marriage.
And you look about 20, so it's quite extraordinary.
Oh, <I don't. laughs> I think for me, the when I started to really sort of question was the fact that my children, the surprising thing about parenthood was that my children are so different from myself and so different from my husband and so different from each other. So they're all very, very sort of quite strong characters and very individual. And I found as I was, you know, parenting that I was finding it very difficult to sort of shoehorn them into this particular way of life. And there sort of came a point where I had to, where for me, I think I had to make a choice as to whether I was going to be, you know, sort of an authoritarian sort of parent and sort of push them into this, or whether I was going to sort of take a step back and think, well, actually, their sort of spiritual life is not really any of my business, and I'm going to let them make these choices for themselves. And it was really important to my husband and I that we didn't go from one extreme to the other. So we didn't say to the children, okay, your whole lives you've had to go to church every Sunday, and now you're not allowed to go to church, because that would have just sort of swung completely the other way. So when we decided we weren't going anymore, we told the children that they could if they wanted, that we would, you know, arrange for them to go with friends of ours. But all of them sort of said, no, thanks. They, you know, they were happy to not go. Although one of my sons surprised us by saying, yes, I will carry on. And we were quite surprised, because he was the one who could never sit still during church. And when we started to make arrangements for him to carry on going, he realised that we meant the whole of church. And what he'd meant was that he'd like to just go at the end to swap Pokemon cards with his friends. We were like, no, that's not really what we'd intended.
So as a family, turning away really from the religion, was that very hard? Did you get a lot of censure from Mormons?
We were really worried. I mean, for about a year, we were talking about it, and we wanted to do it quite gradually for the children as well, because we were worried that they might think that we were sinning or doing something bad by not going. So we sort of disengaged over a period of time. So we stopped going every week, and we just went every other week. And we were very worried. We were worried about what our family would think. We were worried about, you know, friends. We were just worried about silly things like, you know, what if you bump into somebody in Asda or something afterwards, and will it be awkward? And it wasn't. It was great. Everyone was lovely. And so we'd spent all this time really worrying. And everyone's been fine. My husband and my boys still occasionally play football with their friends from church. Our families have been great. So, yeah, you've been good.
You've left the religion. Mm. Do you still believe in God?
No, not really. I would sort of say that I describe myself as agnostic. I believe in human beings. I think you know that people can actually make positive changes. That sort of sitting around and waiting maybe for some supernatural power to do it is a bit of a cop out, I think.
I want to stop here and just hear a little blast of a piece of music that's very important to Mormons. Tell me about this. It's the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. What are they singing?
So this song, Come Come Ye Saints, it's a song that reminds Mormons of the journey that the Mormon pioneers made across America when they were looking for somewhere new to live. And some of the pioneers actually crossed the plains pulling hand carts. And these pioneer stories are really, really important to Mormons. They're really inspiring, and also I think sometimes they're a little bit stifling, because no matter what hardships you face, you know that you're never going to come close to the hardships the pioneers faced. So, but yeah, I still find this piece of music quite, it does make me feel slightly emotional hearing it.
I'm speaking to Cara Spray, who is the author of A Song for Issy Bradley. It's her debut novel, although she's had a book of short stories, a prize-winning book of short stories published already. Cara, could this book have been possible if you were still part of the Mormon faith?
No. I would say no. And I think I didn't write anything, actually, until I left. So I didn't write my short stories until I'd left. And I think... for me, and this isn't the case for everyone, I mean, there are some, you know, there are plenty of Mormon authors out there, but for me, there's a quote by Virginia Woolf that says, if you do not tell the truth about yourself, you cannot tell it about other people. Mm. And that was definitely true of me. So until I admitted my own doubts, until I sort of came clean, I suppose, about the way I felt, I actually didn't feel like I could write authentically at all. And so when I first started writing, I explored sort of maternal ambivalence. That's my short story collection. A lot of it's about that, which is something I felt I couldn't really express as a you know, faithful Mormon. Mm. And then afterwards, I sort of moved on to religion.
This book is garnering absolutely extraordinary reviews. And I have to say that before page 60, I was crying. And that was even before the child has died in the book. It becomes clear that that's what's going to happen. But you have a way of writing it that's not sappy in any way, but is completely emotionally affecting. Do you think that this is because you yourself have suffered great tragedy because you had a child that died and you're writing about this process within the book?
I'm not sure. My second child died as a baby, and I think I was when people find that out, they immediately assume that the mother in the novel is a version of me. But I was at the time I was a devout Mormon, and so actually I was much more like the dad in the novel, very, you know, intent on carrying on and sort of demonstrating to other people that I was carrying on as well. So I even made my poor husband, who our daughter died on the Saturday, and I dragged him to church with me on the Sunday because I felt like, you know, shouldn't miss church. He really didn't want to go, which is, you know, just not wasn't very nice at all. And it's the sort of thing that Ian Bradley in the novel would do. And so I think... I suppose maybe that the experience of my daughter dying did make me interested in how different people respond to grief. And I think I sort of postponed the grieving, actually. I think when my youngest child is also a daughter, and I think when she was born, a lot of it came back, and then maybe that was when I actually dealt with it then, not at the actual time when it happened. But yeah, I am really interested in the way, I suppose, in the spaces that people leave. Mm. And I'm just starting to work on my second novel, which has got no religion in it at all. But it's going to, again, be about grief to an extent, because I'm interested in it. Yeah,
I'm wondering how far people's reaction to the book depends on whether they're parents or not. Have you had a sense of that at all?
I haven't. I know like a few people who've read it who've said that then they sort of obsessively checked their children for a while afterwards, you know, while they were sleeping, just popped upstairs and poked their head around the bedroom door. And it is, you know, it's every parent's nightmare, obviously. Mm. But I think, yeah, I wanted it to be a sad book. And I also wanted it to be a funny book. And so I did try to sort of balance that sadness with some funny stuff as well. So hopefully people might cry, but hopefully there'll be times when they'll laugh too.
Now, you write the story from the perspective of every single member of the family, and yeah. It's an incredible feat to be able to do that across gender and across age. How do you put yourself into those people's spaces?
Well, I felt it was really important to do that for this particular book because I did not want to just provide a sort of single narrative about Mormonism. So I wanted... each character to have different feelings about Mormonism and to be able to show those different ideas and different feelings. Because I was aware that because, you know, Mormonism is a minority religion, and if I just had one narrative strand, it would be like I was saying, this is the way it is, full stop. The different voices were, I found Jacob, the youngest child, really easy. Most of his stuff was you know, drafted and written and was left. And I think that's because, you know, I'm surrounded by children's voices for years. And so, you know, my four children are around all the time. And so he was quite easy. But I did find Ian, the dad, very hard because I was aware that he would be unsympathetic. And I didn't want him to be too unsympathetic. So I would write bits of his and then I'd have to rewrite them and tone them down a bit. And that was difficult. But it was also quite fun because, you know, if you got stuck in one character, you could sort of leave it for a bit and go and work on a different one.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've mentioned that this is part of your PhD and that you're studying creative writing. There's the whole argument that goes around and around and around about whether you can be taught to write or not. Mm-hmm. Clearly, doing it has been beneficial for you. Do you think that you could have written this without the structure of a course?
Not when I started it. No, I don't think so, because I'd done an MA at Edge Hill and I finished the MA, so I did it full time in 1 year, and I really did feel like the most beneficial thing, well, there were two really beneficial things. Firstly, meeting other writers, because I didn't know any other writers in real life until that moment. So I suddenly became part of a writing community. And secondly, was just all the individual recommendations from staff about what to read. So, you know, they were reading my writing and then they were saying to me, well, you'd really benefit from reading this, this and this. And that was so helpful because I just discovered so many fantastic writers. And
It doesn't muddle the voice in your head, does it, by reading other stuff?
No, I think it just opens up more possibilities, you know, seeing the way different. For example, when I was writing my short stories, one of my tutors recommended that I read Helen Simpson's short stories just to see how well people can write about home and family type of things. And, you know, her stories are just exquisite. And I was reading them thinking, oh, this is amazing. And so, yeah, I found it really exciting to discover all these things that I hadn't been aware of before. And I got to the end of that year and just felt a bit like, oh, no, what am I going to do now? And I had a year off where I finished my short story collection. And then I knew I wanted to write a novel. And it just seemed like a really good idea to go back and to do it in a really considered, measured way whilst being supervised and whilst actually really thinking carefully about the process. And I really enjoyed it. And when I have my final viva, I think I might feel a bit sort of, oh no, what am I going to do next?
Well, one of the things, of course, you've been doing at the same time is being a mother to four children.
Yeah.
how difficult has that been?
It's been great because they're all older now. So my oldest son will be going to university next year. So they've been brilliant. I mean, you know, my house isn't as tidy as it used to be. Meals aren't home cooked as often as they were before. But it's been really good. And the kids have been great, and they've been really excited as well, you know, to see how well things have gone for me, which has been lovely.
Well, they have gone extremely well, and I think that they're only going to get better. Your book, A Song for Issy Bradley, published in hardback by Hutchinson, I think is on its way to being a Booker winner. I hardly ever say that. I think this is a marvellous, marvellous piece of work. Cara Spray, thanks for coming in to me. Foyles is a family-run bookshop which has existed since 1903. For the last 134 years, Britain's best-known and probably best-loved purveyor of literature has been occupying premises on London's Charing Cross Road, an address synonymous the world over with bookshops. Now it's moved, but only a few yards down the street, to the former Central St Martin's College of Art and Design building, which has been clarified and simplified by architects Lifschutz, Davidson, Sanderlands. To find out how one makes a bookshop for the 21st century, I met up with Retail Operations Director for Foyles, Sean Hamilton, and Lead Architect, Alex Lifschutz, who began by telling us about the previous location.
We're here at Manette Street, just off Charing Cross Road, looking at the old Foyles, a building that's just been vacated. It's a slightly scruffy building and much loved, but now no longer the foils that it used to be because the new store has moved two doors up the road.
Now, the whole saga of the store moving is obviously a big story in itself. Sean, when did you become aware of the fact that actually your present premises were no longer viable?
Well, we've always had an inkling of that. First, as the market changed. So, I mean, this was a bookshop that was built for another age, I suppose. As things moved forward, you could see that it wasn't really cutting the mustard. Just we knew it needed a lot of work structurally and internally. And then the option of St. Martin's came up and we grabbed it.
Describe the old building to me.
Well, I think it's five buildings knocked into one, essentially? It's a sort of a labyrinth of rooms, which had its charm, and very old-fashioned, I suppose, in its as a bookshop, sort of very claustrophobic it can be at times, but also exciting. There was an element of discovery wandering through it, very easy to get lost in, though.
Let's hear about that building from an architectural point of view, the old building, Alex, as far as you're concerned.
Well, there are some old buildings that have a lot of character, but I would say to you that this one had a charisma bypass. I mean, it really isn't much of a building. We looked at it. We looked very carefully at keeping it, at restoring it, changing it around, but it didn't seem to have very much merit in its own right. Plus, Foyles needed to stay on site and trading, and so it didn't seem to be appropriate or even possible to move them out, restore the building and move them back in. As I say, the prize wasn't there anyway because the building isn't that good. And if you think back to the time when we first started, which was just after the crash in 2008, it is really quite an act of faith for Foyles to have put money, serious amount of money, into this project to move the building up the road, as I say, and to do it in the face of A, the revolution in web sales, and B, the crash in the market that really sent the high streets in London, you know, for six.
It feels rather bizarre walking into a bookshop that I visited often and loved, which was always crowded with books and was always quite difficult to find one's way around. Now suddenly it looks a little bit sad. All the shelves are completely empty. In fact, it feels like it's echoing, like the ghosts of books past have left their mark here. Sean, does it feel a little bit sad to be in this space with all the books gone?
Of course it feels a bit sad. I mean, I've spent 12 years here. Spent more time in this building than I have sleeping in my own bed, actually, in the last 12 years. And we were here over 85 years, we were in here before that. So you can't help but have some emotional connection to it.
Just give me a little bit of the history of Foyles, because it's a family business.
That's right. It was originally opened in 1903 after the William and Gilbert Foyle failed their civil service entry exams and started to sell their textbooks. They saw there was a business for books. They eventually opened one on Cecil Court, a bookshop down there, and they slowly moved up Charing Cross Road over the years until they ended up in this present site.
And the site was used not only for selling books, but also for various concerts and events.
Oh, definitely. We've always been events heavy as an organisation because we feel that it adds a certain life. A bookshop, it's not just about books, it's about the content of books. And it's about theatre. So they've always been an essential part of us. So we have in-store events, that things that would happen on the floor almost spontaneously. We'd also have proper readings and just all sorts of things.
And jazz.
Oh, yes. We always sold music. Eventually we incorporated Ray's Jazz. We used to be on Shaftesbury Avenue and they came along, we took them under our wing, and now it's a blossoming section in our store. We also sell classical music as well. And in fact, actually John Elliott Gardner, the conductor, is going to be doing one of the events for us on the festival.
Now, Alex, here we are. You obviously had to spend a lot of time in this building looking at what Foyles was to decide how it might and indeed now is.
To some extent, I spent as little time here as possible, if I'm truthful. But I think one of the things that gives you a clue about a new space is, particularly if you're refurbishing a building, is that building itself. And the St. Martin's School of Art is a really inspirational building. We'll walk into it in a moment. And it has its own character. So to some extent, that led the process of design. It wasn't an idea that came out of the ether. It comes from both the Foyles brief and from the existing building, the new building that we're going to see in a moment, but that existing structure.
Quite extraordinary that this building should be available and next door.
I think that building had been trailed for a while. It was known that the College of Art was moving up to King's Cross, and Foyles had been tracking progress with what was to happen with the old building. So they knew about it, and we did a number of studies to show that actually it would be a very handsome building for them to occupy.
Well, let's walk down now to the new building, which is just next door. Alex, if we could talk as we go about having to bear in mind all the different aspects of a bookshop when sitting down to design this. I know that you're known for making spaces that can grow with businesses, things that can move around and adapt to various needs. Is that something that you've had to incorporate into the new building?
Yes, I think it is it's the hallmark of a successful business that it should not be hamstrung by its buildings, that buildings should actually liberate rather than enslave, whether it's homes or businesses. But certainly in the case of a business like the book business, which is changing all the time, it's really important that the building doesn't limit the possibilities for growth and for change.
Here we are now. We're on the very, very busy Charing Cross Road, and we're outside the new building. Now, above the double entrance we have here, it says London County Council St Martin's School of Art.
Yes, they were confident enough to actually have the title of the building etched into, well, actually in the faience of the stonework of the facade, College of Distributive Trades and St Martin's School of Art, a building that was shared between two institutions. And we'll see when we go inside that the assembly hall was shared again by those two institutions. Very handsome building with at least six floors on the main road, very tall floor-to-ceiling heights, and lots of light. A complete change from the previous building, which was, dare I say, it slightly pokey.
In terms of the fabric, the structure of this building, it was first built when?
In 1938-39 it was completed, and then it was occupied pretty much by St Martin's for the last 20 or 30 years with lots of very ad hoc changes to the interior. Very, very creative environment with students and staff and administration making changes as they saw fit. As I say, ad hoc, and a rabbit warren of different spaces when we first arrived and had a look at the site.
So, Sean, we're now walking into the building, and I know that you had to open it for the first time. That must have been a very emotional experience.
Yeah, it definitely was. I'm not scared of saying I actually burst into tears when we opened the doors. It was just a sheer delight in finishing the space up in time and just getting this wonderful business to move on into a new era. It was just so exciting.
So here I am, I'm walking into the brand new Foyles for the very first time. It's a building filled with light. It has an industrial feel. The silver pipework is all exposed, and it's very light and bright. Sean, what was your first reaction when you saw the plan for the space?
Oh, excitement. Because this is the sort of thing I was very much looking for as operations director. The previous building worked very well in an older form of bookselling. And when people didn't so much cross-shop, in those days, you know, there was no internet. So if you wanted something, you went and you searched for it. So you went to specific rooms, specific areas. Now things have changed. You could do that research at home. So what we're looking for now is how booksellers and how retailers can bring things out of the sheer sort of deluge of information that's available. I mean, how many hits you get when you type in Shakespeare, for example, on the internet. Now I see a retailer and a bookseller's job is to sort of start curating that stock, saying, well, you don't want those 10 books, you want this one. But to do that, you need a more open space. You need to have the opportunity to direct people in the right way. Whereas in a labyrinthy setup that we had previously, it just wouldn't work.
Alex, describe to me then what you see as you walk into the new Foyles.
Well, the first thing is a very large shop window, which is beautifully set up by Foyles. And they have a team in-house that does this. And they're very interesting and sort of slightly quirky way in which they actually foreground the things that they think are interesting. We've walked through that space. We've walked through a small atrium, which has a very interesting distinguishing feature of the floors on either side of that atrium being at half levels up or down from each other. And we've connected those floors with stairs that effectively are only a half a flight. So we think it's quite easy to walk around the atrium either going up or down because you only move up half a flight at a time. And we've just now entered the old assembly hall, which served both the College of Distributive Trades and St Martin's, but had been actually decked over. And we've opened this up. And so we've got, I think, a really interesting set of spaces, small but really intriguing spaces with raised decks and galleries around it, and a place where we think there'll be talks, there'll be expositions and debates, and Sean is setting all of that in motion with his festival, which follows very shortly.
Let's move off now around the space, and perhaps you can just tell us a little bit about it as we go. For instance, what materials mostly are we looking at? What have you used?
The floor is actually the original rosewood floor, which we retained and which has been restored. The walls are mainly white. As I say, we've cleared away some of the excessive amounts of structure from the St. Martin's days, and the bookshelves are a light colour, and we work very long and hard with Foyles to decide on the colour and the nature of those bookshelves. And for us, they are a bit of a victory in terms of giving the bookseller a lot of freedom in the way in which he and they can display the books and actually organise the space. So they're used as partitions. They're used partly to divide the spaces up so that you'll see, or we'll be able to experience as we go up the floors, different kinds of space which Sean has laid out for different kinds of purpose. And that's entirely at his disposal, that tool of using the bookshelves to set out spaces. And that's a way in which, as architects, we finesse the problem of, well, how should this department be or that department be? It's a question of what the bookseller wants at that particular moment in time.
We're making our way up the building, and in fact we keep saying that we're going to do this in a different way, but there's so much to talk about that we keep stopping to discuss it. And what we're doing now is we're actually, well, perhaps Alex, you could tell us where we are and what it looks like.
We're at the balustrade around the atrium, and we've got some shelves here which terminate in a sort of lectern, in a continuous lectern with some quite good lighting, so that you can flick through a book and maybe even read half a chapter or even a chapter just leaning, lounging here, whilst you also can look at all the people going up the stairs and coming down the stairs. So you can people watch, read your book, and just take a break. The bookshelf has a second function, which is that below this lectern is a large space where at the moment Sean's got some books that he wants people to have a look at, but there's one or two in each space. At Christmas or at special events, he can load the whole of that base up. He can turn the books to face out, as it were, so that from the atrium side, as you look up this atrium, you'll be able to see dozens and dozens of bookshelves stacked with either one copy or many copies of books that are particularly interesting.
We were talking about the colour of the shelves and how they are very light here. And Sean, you were saying, of course, it's important to remember that books generally are quite dark.
That's indeed, that's right. Books are quite dark, and there's a lot of information on them, which is sounds like an obvious thing to say, but it is important to think of. And it's interesting, when you say, if you stand at this distance here, they can form almost just a wallpaper, a very attractive wallpaper, but a wallpaper. And I feel that when you have darker shelves, it just feels very heavy and not as inviting. By using a lighter material, you just bring the books out a little bit more and make you more likely to sort of want to explore and wander around.
You've very cleverly, with the architects, worked a way in which it doesn't feel overwhelming.
That's right. Something we were very aware of with books. We wanted to show people that there was a depth of range and stock, and people to be aware of that, which in the old store they weren't always so sure because of so many rooms. But on the other hand, we didn't want to overwhelm them. So by creating spurs and breaks in the runs, it leaves you a tantalising glimpse at the stock that you want to explore, but while not overwhelming you, not thinking, oh my God, where do I start?
But where do you start? If you walk into the shop and you think, right, I'm looking for a specific book, and you perhaps don't even know what genre it is there a way of finding that?
Well, indeed there is. We're actually working on an application that goes on your phone at the moment that we basically will enable you to type in a title, and then you click on where you are, and it will show you a map on how to get to that case. Still in its beta testing stage at the moment, because now we've settled down, we need to accurately map things, but it's lovely. It's a lovely way of shopping. We're really proud of it.
And of course, the whole digital age and the way that influences the way we shop and the spaces that we shop in, that must have been a big consideration for you, Alex.
Yes and no, because to be honest, the reason that people still come to cities and come to stores like this is because they want to meet other people. They want to see what they're doing. They want to be together with them. They want to distance themselves from them. They want to be in a social situation. And the digital age gives you very little of that experience. If really the digital phenomenon was to take off, we'd all be living in towns like Basingstoke, I suspect, although I don't really want to diss Basingstoke, and ordering our books on a certain retailer and waiting for a delivery man to arrive. It's not a very sensual way of enjoying culture.
Sean, we're now going from the first up to the second floor, and again, a beautiful streamlined flight of stairs, and alongside we have a bookshelf that echoes the stairs going up the side. Tell me about that.
We needed to do something, I think, to dress the atrium in an attractive manner. A long time ago we did workshops to talk about the future bookshop. It was the beginning of 2013, and someone suggested a Yo Sushi conveyor belt of books running up the building, and of course I couldn't quite let that go, and we racked our brains about it. And it was only when I was going up an escalator at Regent Street Station, Tube Station, going past the panels, and I realised, hang on, if I flip it so that the customer becomes the escalator and the books become static, then you've got the same thing. So there it is. It basically enables you to explore and be exposed to titles you perhaps you're not looking for as you move up to a level and you see something that catches your eye, which is, in fact, on our opening day, that's exactly what happened, and it was lovely to see.
The customer as sushi.
Yeah.
Congratulations, Sean. The shop is beautiful.
Sean, that's just one person saying that to you. I believe that since it opened, the public have been really quite overwhelmed.
Generally, amazing reception. I mean, people have been delighted, surprised, amazed. And what's been fantastic for me is seeing how much of a younger, I suppose, if I'm not that old myself, I'm only 40, but a younger generation coming in here with just smiling when they see the space and just saying that they're just looking forward to just visiting here time and time again.
And so really, Foyles for a whole new generation, people that grew up on the kind of dark, creaky old shop, suddenly coming to life and coming back to something completely new.
Definitely, and I think it's something that they couldn't have imagined it, but I think it's what they want. It's what they wanted, it's what they were looking for. This whole building reflects the changes in the way we buy books now when we come to a physical store.
How do we buy books?
Well, I think we want to be tantalised more. As I've said before, there's a great Umberto Eco wrote a great piece on it. He said, you write a piece on Shakespeare. In the old day, you would go and there'd be one stack of books on Shakespeare. You'd pick the books you wanted, you'd write, and it'd be fine. Nowadays, you type into the internet and you get over a million hits. You turn the computer off and you walk away. He said, so it's a similar sort of thing. You want to be browsed, you want to be beguiled. You want to know there's range there. You want to know there's depth. You want to be able to explore, but you also don't want to be overwhelmed. And I think that's what a physical bookshop needs to do now. It needs to really push the social interaction side of buying a book. The eye contact, the smile, the recommends, all of those things. And I think this building does that.
And, of course, the events where people can come and meet other people and enjoy perhaps your authors or various other things. And we're now in the events space. So, Alex, tell me about the thought behind this wonderful, airy, bright room.
Well, Foyles have always had a tradition of events, literary events, social events, and this room is that in its new incarnation. It's a rectangular room with lots of light down one wall overlooking Charing Cross Road, a big red curtain along the other wall, which can be pulled across a glass screen that looks over the atrium. So a very handsome room, services on the ceiling fully exposed so that they can plug into whatever they want, they can extend or adapt whatever they want, and the floor is a handsome mid-oak colour. So a really nice, pleasant space that will be filled with, hopefully, laughter and culture.
The launch was marked by a glittering party. One of the speakers was writer Catlin Moran.
Foyles was always beautiful, on the inside. It always had lovely eyes. But now, Foyles is beautiful on the outside as well. Let's face it, if all the other shops on this street could get together in a pub, maybe downstairs at the Phoenix, what would they all be talking about? They would all be discussing the fact that this is the shop in this street that they would most like to do it with. As with libraries, a bookshop in the middle of a community is a cross between an emergency exit, a life raft, and a festival. These are the cathedrals of our mind, these are the hospitals of our soul, and the theme parks of our imagination. And this one is just about to make me pregnant with its sexiness, and I'm going to give birth to a load of tiny paperbacks. Thank you very much.
You gave a great speech here at the opening of Foyles. What an honour.
Oh, God, no, it really was. I was so thrilled. First of all, I've always loved Foyles. When I first started coming down to London, the old Foyles, and indeed the new Foyles, was right next to the Astoria, where there are loads of rock gigs would play. And I was still underage at the time, and so I couldn't go and meet in the pubs with all of the cool grown-ups. And so before gigs used to come on, I used to just walk around Foyles for hours before going to see some kind of dirty, heavy rock band at the Astoria. So this has always felt like a second home to me. I knew its toilets intimately. So to be invited along to its beautiful, new, glamorous Two Doors Down makeover was an utter thrill and honour.
What do you think?
Oh, it's beautiful. I mean, I'd like to describe the ambience here, but it's a combination of kind of calm, sexy, intellectual thoughtfulness with a slight frisson of people looking over the top of bookshelves at each other going, will we get off with each other? In other words, the perfect bookshop.
Hold on, just a little while longer. Hold on, just a little while longer.
Susie Nicklin's a literary agent. Has one of the oldest, most established and most respected literary agencies in London. Susie, what do you think of this?
It's absolutely stunning. The architecture is fabulous, but in particular, the amount of books that are stocked here is mind-blowing. I have to say, everybody should come here immediately.
What do you think this is going to mean for your authors?
I think they will enjoy being displayed alongside their peers very, very much. And I think the way that the whole curation has been done is very innovative and exciting for them.
David Nicol, what do you think of the new Foyles?
It's great. I mean, it's obviously there's a party here at the moment, so it's hard to get a clear view, but it's big and confident and bright and not at all the kind of dingy, dusty bookshop that you expect. It's very confident and brazen, and it's terrific.
Your book, One Day, was the most enormous hit. Do you think that the way that it sold was at all influenced in the environment in which people were viewing it, i.e. coming into bookshops? Were they buying it more there, or were they getting it online?
There were a lot of sales online, but I think it wasn't launched with any real fanfare, and it became a kind of word-of-mouth thing, certainly when it was in hardback. And I think word-of-mouth doesn't really exist in the same way online. The online company is so much in charge, you don't get the same contact with booksellers and other book readers. So I think bookshops are crucial for that. I think they're a real hub for a conversation and enthusiasm for books. So I know a lot of booksellers were very passionate about One Day, and I'm really, really grateful for that. I know a lot of bookshops, especially independent bookshops, that really pushed it really passionately. And what novelist wouldn't want that behind them?
Is this a place that you personally will come to again?
Yeah, absolutely. I love it. I think it's, you look around and it's not the same books. There are all kinds of intriguing books on the shelves, and it's a real book lover's paradise. I think it's a terrific place.
This is Johnny Geller from Curtis Brown. He's a literary agent. What do you think of the new Foyles?
Well, I think it's really exciting, actually. It's got the kind of Barnes & Noble plus sort of feel to it. So it's got that American big space with its own character. I really like it. I like the design, the layout. So I hope people will come. And also maybe tourists will feel this is a destination place. So business should be good.
Well, that's interesting you should say that. In his speech, Christopher Foyle was talking about Harrods or Liberty and various destination shops. This definitely has a feel that it might be like that.
Yes, I think Foyles still has that unique name. I mean, Waterstones obviously moved into the old Simpsons in Piccadilly, but there's something about Foyles which ignites the imagination for most English students, and they always grew up going there and probably shoplifting, I don't know. Whereas this seems like a place you would come if you were visiting London. So I hope that will then allow for, you know, much more business, to be honest.
Paul Gorman, tell me what you think of this new building.
I really like it, actually. I remember coming here in the 70s. My friends worked here, and it was an absolute warren. It was very Dickensian. And what they've done with it is really open it out and make it interesting and inviting. And that's a very important thing for somebody like me who's written 10 books and is still desperately hoping that people are buying books rather than e-books or not buying them at all. And, you know, what's happened over the last few years is that e-books have gone on the downturn. And books as objects and things to have and things to admire and things to contemplate and enjoy have come back. So that's good news for authors.
The last word must go to the man who designed Foyle's new home, architect Alex Lifschutz.
One of the things I think has been most fun about this is that this is a very interesting institution. This is an institution that's lasted for over 100 years and yet is totally young at heart. It's most unusual to find people and companies that can regenerate the sort of spirit of a founding generation 100 years on. This building will hopefully allow them to generate and regenerate that very young, very quirky, very immediate and very thoughtful spirit that has taken the bookshop as far as it's come so far. There's no question in my mind that this will work as a social instrument. It's a place where you'll have really, really enjoyable meetings of minds and of understanding new forms of books.
The Foyles Grand Opening Festival continues to Friday the 4th of July with an all-star programme of events to launch the flagship store at 107 Charing Cross Road. One of those events will feature a couple of my other guests from today, authors Caris Bray and Nick Harkaway, who take part in the Literary Death Match next Thursday. That's the live literary game show to mark the opening of the new space for this world-renowned family-run bookshop.